What is up, you rough, rug-headed kerns? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's So You're Going to See Shakespeare episode. The idea of these episodes is that it's something you'd listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Richard II.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into the episode is a quick synopsis of the play so you at least know the story. Dan, take it away.
Yes, King Richard II summons Henry Bolingbroke and Thomas Mowbray, two rivals, to his court so that he can help put their long-standing beef to rest. In front of the king, Bolingbroke accuses Mowbray of embezzling, treason, and the murder of the Duke of Gloucester. Mowbray denies across the board, and they decide to decide who is telling the truth via duel. Richard tries to talk them out of it, but neither steps down, so the duel is scheduled.
When the day of the duel comes around, Mowbray and Bolingbroke appear before Richard to settle things once and for all. But before the first blow is struck, Richard announces that he has instead decided to exile both of them instead of having one kill the other, as that could spark a civil war.
After Bolingbroke has left England, his father and advisor to Richard, John of Gaunt, takes to his deathbed, but not before essentially cursing Richard. Immediately upon his death, Richard announces that he'll be confiscating all of Gaunt's vast fortune for himself, despite the fact that they rightfully should have gone to the very recently exiled Henry Bolingbroke. This is not a popular move.
In another unpopular move, Richard mobilizes his troops and announces an expedition to Ireland in an effort to bring them under English rule. As the generals of the army meet before shipping off, it is revealed that Henry Bolingbroke is gathering an army with the intention of returning to England and overthrowing the tyrannous Henry. The generals think that Henry's cause is the just one and defect to the rebellion rather than go with Richard to Ireland.
As Richard ships off with the bulk of his army to Ireland, Henry's army arrives in England. The Duke of York, having been left in charge while Richard shipped off, doesn't know what to do, as there are almost no soldiers left for defense, and the people are far more likely to join the popular Henry over the unpopular Richard. He goes to Henry as that army marches towards the capital and chastises him for returning before his exile's period is over. Henry says that he was exiled as Duke of Hereford, but since his father died, he is technically now Duke of Lancaster, and the exile no longer applies. The Duke of York, knowing he is severely outmanned, tells Bolingbroke he still considers him a rebel, but will remain neutral in the conflict between Henry and Richard.
Richard returns from Ireland, confident that he can quell Henry's insurrection, until he receives word that the Welsh forces, who hadn't heard any word from him for several weeks, went home because they thought he was dead. This is going to be problematic for Richard.
Upon receiving word that York and many other generals have also defected to Henry, Richard acknowledges his cause is lost, dismisses his troops, and awaits his fate at Henry's hands.
Once captured, Richard announces Henry is the lawful heir and will assume the throne upon his death. Richard is forced to abdicate the throne publicly and then also read the list of accusations against him. He does so, and as soon as he's done, he is sent to the Tower.
Amidst all the successes, Henry asks his people about what his wild child son is up to these days, and they say he's being pretty wild. This isn't so important in this play, but put a pin in that for the Henry 4-5 plays. It ends up being pretty important.
Well, trapped in his cell in the Tower, Richard is cornered by the Duke of Exton, who kills him. Exton goes to Henry to deliver the news, but Henry knows this is a real bad look for him and exiles Exton. With the rebellions all quelled and the rebel leaders all exiled or executed, Henry commits to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land to clear his soul of any wrongdoing that occurred during the ascension to the throne, and resolves to be prominently featured in at least two more Shakespeare plays. And that is Richard II. Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Richard II falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written, Dan.
Yes. So for Richard II, we have 1595 as the year that this play was written. In terms of Shakespeare's timeline, he also wrote Romeo and Juliet and A Midsummer Night's Dream that year. So pretty good year for Shakespeare. Despite the fact that R&J and Dream are produced a hell of a lot more often than R2, mm-hmm. I would argue that the verse in this one is just as good as the other two.
Oh, for certain.
So he's in a sweet spot.
And to piggyback on that, in this group, the perfect rhymes in Richard II extend to roughly a quarter of the total lines in the play, which is bananas.
Yeah.
That's a lot of rhyming. And the only plays with more perfect rhymes in them are Comedy of Errors, Love's Labour's Lost, and Midsummer Night's Dream. So somebody bought Shakespeare a rhyming dictionary around 1593,
right.
And he was really just tearing it up during this window of time.
Super into rhymes.
Totally.
It was just the time.
Ill rhyme saying.
To rhyme.
Nice.
There, you like that? So in terms of Shakespeare's living situation, it's kind of interesting. This year he's living at St. Helen's Parish in Bishopsgate. So this was a period of time where he would have been living basically in a evangelical Anglican church. At the same time, in September of 1595, there is a fire in Stratford-upon-Avon. So it's an interesting idea of what's happening where you are versus where you're from. For Shakespeare personally was relevant, but it's also a theme in the play of like, I'm here, but I should be there.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to go like, oh, how does that inform how you write?
Right. And then in terms of the greater political goings-on of the time, Elizabeth I was frequently identified with Richard II, specifically because of both of them having an unsettled succession, that Richard II's succession was somewhat in question because you pretty much can't transfer succession to somebody else just because you said so, traditionally.
Right.
And then Elizabeth I, of course, not having an heir. Elizabeth was very aware of this and not exactly flattered by it, but
right.
She was on record saying to William Lambard in 1601, "I am Richard II. No, you're not that."
No, you're not.
It's like, oh, okay. Probably not something I would have brought up in a dinner conversation, but
right,
takes
right.
it a little personally.
It's really interesting, her awareness of that. In June of the same year, there's the Battle of Fontaine-Français,
oui.
Where Henry IV of France defeats the Spanish. But he is killed during this battle due to his rashness. So there's that sense of like a king who is rash in battle. And then you have a king being depicted here in this play who is not rash, or is rash, but not actively rash.
Sure. It's a different, yeah.
A different kind of sort of like thinking about that sort of stuff. In very different news in terms of what's going on in the world in 1595, just for some context of how long ago this is, heels appear for the first time on shoes.
Oh.
And also, bow and arrows are abolished as weapons of war in this year.
Where? In Europe?
In Europe.
No kidding.
And you have Richard, spoilers, who has some arrows shot at him in the same year that it's like, nope, we don't use those anymore.
Huh.
We're civilized now.
Very interesting.
Right?
Well, there you go. That's a little history of Richard II. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play, and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I'll pick one of those for us to dig in on. Daniel.
Yes.
What are our finalists?
So our finalists for best theme in Richard II are action versus inactivity, language, and assertions of right. Action versus inactivity, language, or assertions of right.
Let's do action versus inactivity.
Wonderful. I was hoping you would choose that one.
Yeah.
And what led you to that there? Okay.
So I think it's interesting in that, you know, you contrast the two, what I would consider the two bad kings in the War of the Roses plays, would be Richard II and Henry VI. Neither of them are particularly effective kings.
Bad meaning like bad meaning like bad
at their job.
Okay, got it.
Good clarification.
Okay.
And I think one of the things, Henry VI has real Hamlet-esque inability to pull the trigger, to make the hard decisions, whatever.
Right.
Richard doesn't have a hard time pulling the trigger on decisions. He just has real bad decisions. You know, where it's like, I'm going to Ireland. Are you sure you should do that? I'm 100% sure.
Yeah.
I think you might want to stick around. Well, I'm gone. Where are my shamrocks at?
Sláinte.
Right, exactly. Or like, you know, pulling the trigger on taking John of Gaunt's entire inheritance and plucking it from Henry.
Yep.
And being like, this is a great idea. And like,
yeah.
The people hate you. I'm good.
I hate the people.
I'm the king.
Right. No, you not. Who I am.
Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And thinking, too, about the play starts with such an active, it's a build-up for, like, an epic showdown. And then Richard cuts it off.
Right.
To be like, no, like, it's going to be a huge duel. Like, what a way to start a play.
Right, with Mowbray and Bolingbroke.
Yeah, like, oh, we're going to have a, like, it's a joust or it's, like, a tournament.
Yeah.
It's just, like, what an active start. And then the king is like, no, you're both banished. It's like, okay.
Right, the crowd should boo.
Like, there goes the dramatic action.
Right.
Now we have a play about banishment. It's like, okay, well, that's cool.
Right.
But I think, too, in thinking about what draws the people in the play to Bolingbroke eventually is that he is so active that he gets kicked out and comes back and mounts. He mounts a counterattack, and their king is nowhere to be found. So it is that sense of taking action against your words versus like, you know, why don't we just all sit around and like, let's talk about what people will say about me later.
Right. With which Richard gets to. Right. Yeah.
Richard, there's this idea that Richard is more obsessed with what people will say about him in hundreds of years than he is
what like, people
with
say,
him right now.
Yeah. What his people outside say.
He cares more about his own legacy and story. Than creating one.
Yeah.
That it's like, I just want to, like, let's imagine what they'll say about me.
Right.
He's like, well, they're not going to say anything because you're not doing anything.
Right.
And that's Bolingbroke's whole argument. It's like, I'm going to, this is my land now.
Yeah.
I'm taking it from you actively, and the people will love me for it.
Right.
And they do.
Yeah.
So there's that sense of the action versus inactivity.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, so other inactivity could be.
With the Welsh?
Yeah, right, that he doesn't, right, he just doesn't even go get him.
Doesn't send a messenger?
Yeah, it's like, can we delay for, you know, I'm coming from Ireland back to England. Wales is on the way. Like, it's not a big diversion.
Right.
Like, we can pop in,
right.
You know? But yeah, he just, like, gives up, and then, like, not wanting to read. You know, basically, once he knows he's screwed, he turns into, like, a toddler who just, like, lays on the ground at the supermarket.
Yep.
And is like, I'm not doing it.
I'm done.
Yeah.
This party's over.
Right.
It's that email that you think you sent and then didn't send.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, you know what? I don't think I sent that. But then you don't check.
No.
It's like, gone.
Oh, well.
Darn.
We'll
I missed it.
Well,
there's like, there are lives at stake for this one. Oh,
sorry.
King. Which it ultimately is interesting because then it ends up propelling him into a room alone with himself.
Right.
Where he's like, well, this is kind of all I've ever wanted.
Yeah, right.
He's like, I have my whole kingdom right here. I can just imagine it.
Yeah.
And that's peaceful.
It's interesting.
But he's like, I have inactivity. And like he has a very active imagination.
Yeah.
As opposed to a very active body.
Action. Right, like, exactly, yeah.
Like, he's thinking all the time.
A very active political platform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
interesting. So there you go. Action versus inaction. Keep an eye out for it when you head out to see this production. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show.
Yes, I did.
And has elected to go first. So here we go.
Yes. So in Richard II, if I can't play King Richard II, which is a true shame, I think the part that I would most like to play is John of Gaunt.
Damn it.
It's one of those great roles where you get to come on, like you're done. It's a 7 o'clock curtain. You're done by 7:20, but you've been speaking for like 18 minutes. Great text.
I'll see you at the bar. I'll be back for curtain call. I'm about 30 years too young for this, but I have range, so I could play it. I just like his relationship and some of the stuff. It's a cool, when you think about the play as the beginning of a bigger set of four plays, the idea of like the old regime dying right at the front is kind of cool in terms of like, okay, we're as one, it's he childed as I fathered. It's that sense of like one thing is ending as a new whole system is beginning. So I would probably play John of Gaunt, but also commission plays about John of Gaunt that I could also star in.
Okay.
To be done with this company.
Like,
that I'd be playing Gaunt in.
Prior?
Yeah, prequels. I also think that my good friend, I mean, I like to play roles that dear friends of mine have played.
Uh-huh.
So Patrick Stewart played this in the Hollow Crown series, who's a dear friend of mine. So I think that I would go with John of Gaunt.
Okay. That's good. So John of Gaunt, as you could tell by my swear, was who I was going to take for all the same reasons, and that his he has a fantastic monologue.
Yeah, they're beautiful but monologues.
If John of Gaunt is off the board, I guess, you know, looking down the roster, I would have to go with, what's his name? He ends up being the Duke of Lancaster. Oh, Henry. I'll be him.
Yeah.
Because he does do one of my favorite things, which is being technically right repeatedly, where, you know, a big struggle in this is that Henry wants to, you know, as evidenced by the fact that he goes off to visit the Pope, to visit the Holy Land. Like, I feel kind of icky about this whole thing. I'm right.
Kicky icky?
Icky icky woo woo. Oh. Like, I feel like I have all my paperwork in order for certain.
Yeah.
But I do feel a little weird about this, but even like his, you know, he breaks out the family trees and he's like, well, this guy led before this guy and this guy was connected to this guy and this brother's older than that brother. Like, this isn't just a hostile takeover.
Right.
This isn't what happens when they kill Henry VI later on.
Right.
Where
right,
it's
right,
just
right.
like, we're the king now.
Right.
Henry believes and has the proof to show you that he is the rightful king.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I like the technicalities. I like how he shows his work.
Yep.
And I think that type of meticulous attention to detail is a fun thing that I like to play with. That is not interesting to watch, but I but it is something I like to dig in on. It's something that I think I actually think Richard III is the same way, that he knows exactly what the order of like algebra, the order of events need to be.
Yep.
And yeah, so Henry in this play, more he appeals to me more as a character in this play than in the Henry plays.
That's really interesting.
You know,
and this is there's some debate about the pronunciation of the last name in terms of like in your world when you play this character, how would you prefer that this name is pronounced? And the options that are thrown out there are Bolingbroke, 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 Bolingbroke.
I love I like the Bolingbroke idea, so I may go with that.
Okay.
But I've always said Bolingbroke.
Oh, interesting.
I don't, not just because that's the way it looks like to me.
Yeah, right? It looks like.
Yeah. But he can be a bull.
Right?
He will be a bull.
He has that sort of twirl energy.
Okay, sure. We'll go with that.
Is twirl a word?
It is now. Let us know if those or any other roles jump out to you in the production that you go to see. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from Richard II is, "Whate'er I be, nor I, nor any man that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing." From Act 5, Scene 5. Let's hear the phrase in context.
Thus play I in one person many people, and none contented. Sometimes am I king, then treasons make me wish myself a beggar, and so I am. Then crushing penury persuades me I was better when a king, then am I kinged again, and by think that I am unkinged by Bolingbroke, and straight am nothing. But whate'er I be, nor I, nor any man that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing.
Thank you, Daniel. That is, whate'er I be, nor I, nor any man that but man is with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing.
Whoa.
Daniel.
Yeah.
You want to give us a little context on this?
Oh, please. Act 5, Scene 5. This is the beginning of the play. So quite clearly, this is the end. Richard is alone in his prison and basically is talking to himself and just making a world for himself and thinking through, like, all the different things. Oh, there's this, there's that. Oh, I could be this, I could be that, I could be this. Whatever I am, like, he spent his whole life. It's a moment of zen. It's a moment of,
sure,
like,
of reflection.
I've spent my whole life wanting to be this thing. And in thinking so, I just was never anything, because I was always trying to be something that I'm not. But then he comes to, like, I don't have the kingdom anymore. I don't have a crown. I have nothing but myself and this room. And for the first time, I'm happy.
Huh. Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? That's all we need.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the great lesson of the play for him. It's like, you don't need to be king. If all you wanted was legacy and stories, that's what you're born with.
Right.
Like, that's what we all have.
Yeah.
So forget, like, conquering Ireland.
Right.
And conquering, like, it's cool, man.
Yeah.
Like,
don't be a hero.
Once you're cool with being nothing, then you can be something.
Yeah.
It's paradox, right?
Yeah,
it's Shakespeare's
totally.
Paradox.
But. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's an interesting monologue in that Richard is, like, for all the reasons that we've already covered, pretty tough to like for the majority of this play.
Yeah.
You know, both in being kind of petulant and being, you know, like things like breaking up the duel when you're like, oh, I really wanted to see that.
I was looking forward to that.
You know, and he just constantly is doing that. And, like, you're almost certainly siding with Henry the way this is written. You know, it's tough to really get on Richard's side. Not impossible, just tough.
Just tough.
And then he has this, and you're like,
oh, you're a good man.
This is all he wanted.
Yeah.
He was just wrong place, wrong time.
Just shouldn't have been the king.
Right? If he was one of these, like, Duke of friggin' Herefordshire or whatever, he would have been great.
Yeah.
He would have been, like, just bossed around farmers and just been perfect.
Just but chilling. It's
like, he's just one step too high.
Yep.
You know?
It's that whole, from the thing from Slings and Arrows, it's lonely at the top.
Mm.
Where you're like, I have too many things to do up here. There's so much responsibility. And,
yeah.
Like, it's crushing.
Yeah.
It really is that, like, I just want to throw it all away and just go.
Right.
I want to move to Hawaii.
I want to go open a bookstore in Vermont.
Yeah. That's what it is.
You know?
That's what it is. And you're sitting there like,
this.
Oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
This part's good here.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting, meta theatrically, it's interesting that this only works when you have an audience.
Right. Like, it's him alone. But
it's
he...
him alone with 100 people, 1,000 people,
right.
2,000 people in the audience being like, you're all I need.
Right.
It's a work.
Right.
Like,
totally. Right.
Like, you know, that sense of, I think something, it's relatable living in, I mean, we both live in New York City, that sense of, like, I'm so tired of being surrounded by 8 million people.
Right.
Even if I don't see them, like, I feel you.
Right,
like,
exactly.
We're currently in a building with God knows how many people.
Yeah.
And it's like when you get out to nature and you're just alone in the middle of the woods and you're like, oh, wow.
I'm the only person within 1,000 feet in any direction.
This is so nice.
Yeah. And it's like there are probably 1,000 people 1,000 feet in any direction right now.
Yes,
you know?
Correct.
Yeah,
and it's like, well, it's kind of sweet to think about the hero's journey as Bolingbroke is absorbing a kingdom.
Yeah,
and as so many of Shakespeare's heroes take things over.
Yeah,
here is someone who's like, I didn't want this, but now that I have it, I kind of love it.
Right.
It's a really interesting...
Yeah, it's kind of... You don't really see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the polar opposite of Henry V, which is, I mean, in terms of the Henriad, the sense of, like, the polar attitude of Richard II is where we start, and we end with, like, the greatest king of all time.
Right.
Henry V, who is a band of brothers. And Richard's like, I have me.
I am myself alone.
And I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
Like... It's a pretty good group I have here in my head.
Yeah.
Like,
right?
Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm a schizophrenic and so am I. Like,
right. Yeah, so there you go. Keep an ear out for that line when you head out to see this production. Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Richard II, we think the biggest challenge is the stage direction dashes the glass against the ground from Act 4, Scene 1. Tang, you want to give us a little context on this scene?
It's the moment of abdication in the play, where Bolingbroke is taken over and is like, any requests? And Richard's like, yeah, can you send me a mirror? And like, get him a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, not quite clear what's going on.
Is this like a mirror, mirror on the wall like, situation or what?
I'm like, what is this? And then they bring it in and he's like, hey, can I see that? Can I? Oh yeah, I look pretty good. Oh wow. This is what a king looked like. And then he smashes it. Like, and this is what a king looks like now.
Yeah.
Because I see just like me and just like that mirror, I'm cracked and I'm broken apart.
Uh-huh.
But it technically is a mirror is broken on stage.
Right.
Which is a difficult challenge.
It's a difficult production challenge. And, you know, especially when, you know, one of the joys as someone on the budgeting end of the theater industry, I find in Shakespeare's plays.
Yes.
Doesn't use a lot of props.
No.
Doesn't use a lot of props. Doesn't use a lot of costumes. You know, you look right. at like, even just I've worked on a couple of the mobile tours of Shakespeare that go to like prisons and stuff. And it's like, you couldn't bring Death of a Salesman to a prison, you know?
Right.
It's like, you couldn't bring Glass Menagerie to a prison. It's like, well, we need this record player. Can we get this clear? It's like, you cannot.
Right.
But you
What's
can,
in the record player?
Right. You can do Shakespeare with...
That's really interesting.
Like six sticks and a bunch of cubes and like three pieces.
Yeah.
And if
Which
you
is
were,
what they probably would have had.
Exactly. And so like in this one, when you're looking at, well, what is a prop? Is there any way to get around this mirror? No.
Mm-mm.
We need a mirror.
It's text-based.
Yeah. So you end up with this mirror, and it can't just be, you know, if this is, you know, this is in the 1400s that this is taking place, it can't just be like a compact, like
right.
a little, like, makeup mirror that you
right,
have,
right,
like
right.
a hand size. Like, it's got to be a business mirror.
Sure. Right.
And you got to spike it every night.
Yep.
And if you're doing 8 shows a week for 8 weeks.
What does that cost?
A lot. That
yeah,
perishable
right.
line? Yeah. I mean, it can add up.
Yeah.
So you go to your props person and you're like, we don't need to buy 64 of these, right? And the props person's like, well, if you wanted to look. And I'm like, right? And they're like, all right, well, let me see what I could do.
62?
How about 3?
No.
Yes.
No.
And then they have to go off and figure out how to do it.
Right. It's also, whenever you have anything that reflects, if you're doing, especially if you're in a proscenium, fine.
Right.
Proscenium, for those listening who don't know, that sense of like the stage is at a distance, almost like the two-dimensional.
Yeah, like a movie theater.
Yeah. But if you're doing anything immersive or in the round
yeah.
or a thrust.
Yeah, which is what Shakespeare, yeah, which is what it would have been. Yeah.
And where Shakespeare belongs, if you ask me.
No, peas and carrots.
But like, if the audience can see the mirror, then it needs to reflect.
Right.
And you know who hates that? The lighting designer.
The lighting designer. The like, mirror is the lighting designer's worst enemy.
Right? Because now it's like, oh, great. Now I have 100 pieces of glass that reflect the light I'm putting into a very set spot.
Right.
Everywhere.
And it's incredibly distracting when you have the mirror and he's got to turn it around and be like, look at what this looks like.
Yep.
And it's like, pew! There's a light beam shooting all over the audience, all over upstage, whatever.
Yep.
So how do you solve this?
Well, isn't there a spray?
There is. You can treat a mirror. You can certainly treat a mirror, and especially since it's like a medieval time,
yeah,
you get some liberty in that it's a dirty mirror, so there's dirt on there.
Yeah.
There's some, you can fog it, basically, so you know it's reflective, but it's as reflective as, like, you know, the screen of your phone when it's turned off, or like a Diet Pepsi can that's silver. Like, it reflects yeah. something, but it's not a clean mirror.
Right.
And ideally you want to find something that, you know, you can spike and not break, although it does have to break.
It has to break.
So,
and there's also that sense too, it, coming from an acting point of view of like, if Shakespeare put the prop there, it means a lot.
Right.
So if you have this king, if you're like, I'll play him as sort of ineffectual and weak, but in this moment, I want to smash this mirror.
Right.
Like, throw it, smash it. It is like, how, that's it. I mean, that's, it's a question in rehearsal.
Yeah.
How does your Richard break this mirror?
Right.
Does he drop it like
like drop the mic.
I'm doing a visual of just like, yeah, like, is it a mic drop or is it like a throwing it across the room?
Yeah, for me, it would be a spike.
Does he throw it at Bolingbroke? Does like how does this mirror break?
Yeah.
It's a real challenge because if the actor, I mean, I assume many actors would be like, I want it to be epic. And then you're like, great.
Yeah.
But now how do we do that safely?
And make it safe, right.
Make it safe, make it practical.
Right.
Because that's going to be 64 mirrors. It's
right.
Not, you don't do that with one piece that you put back together.
Exactly. No Humpty Dumpty. But, you know, and we usually say, how has this been solved in the past? I have actually not seen a full production of Richard II.
Nor have I.
So we're skipping that part this week.
I guess so.
But you can let us know how it is done in the production that you are going to see. That's going to do it for us for this week. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so that we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can find us on the web at noholdsbarred.com. You can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can Patreon us at patreon.com. No Holds Barred. You can tweet us at No Holds Barredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com. No Holds Barredcast. So, until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Boyer.
March sadly after, grace my mornings here.
In weeping after this untimely beer.